We left off about here. So, we're going to start talking about choice behavior. That is, making choices. We make all kinds of choices during our day. What do we have for breakfast? How do we get to university? Do we walk, take a car, take the bus? Have yourself shot out of a pneumatic cannon? Do we want to even come to class today? Do we have something else going on that's more important? All kinds of choices. And those choices are actually very, very interesting for psychologists, depending on what aspect of psychology they're intrigued with. The difficulty is, it's very, very hard to actually study these various choices that are made during an average person's day in some sort of quantifiable way. In other words, we have relatively little control. Some people do study these choices. But in the behavioral, your standard sort of comparative psychology field, where we're often utilizing animal models or controlled situations to gain understanding not of perhaps specific behaviors out in a real-world setting, but to understand more about the underlying processes by which a learning and or behavioral process will occur. So the underlying ways that it works, regardless of the specifics, we tend to put more controls in place. Consequently, the way that this is most commonly studied in comparative psychology, which may be different from cognitive psychology or social psychology or developmental, is to utilize a technique called the two-key procedure. It can be a two-lever procedure or a two-button procedure. A lot of this stuff started with pigeons back in the day, and pigeons are quite happy pecking at little keys to get reinforcers, so we just call it the two-key procedure. What happens here, very simply, is, and instantly, this doesn't have to just be done with pigeons. You put levers in there, and you can use it with rats. Use buttons on a keyboard, and you can do this with people. Or you can make a really, I mean, we can do this with people. We've got two doors in this classroom. We could set up a two-door procedure here. Which door will you go out of under different circumstances? Okay. The idea is that you just have two choices. Why two? Because that's easy. You could have a six-key procedure if you really wanted. It just makes it more complicated. You don't need that. I think the most maybe I've seen higher, but I mean, usually this doesn't go over three or four. To understand the underlying principles involved in choice behavior and how subjects learn to make those choices, all you need to make a choice are two options. Okay? Now, in the real world, there may be many more than two. My wife and I are looking at her family's gotten larger, and we're outgrowing our Toyota Matrix, so we're going to need to be getting a larger car, and I pretty much, for personal reasons, refuse to buy a minivan. So it's what kinds of options are available to us. We've got a lot of options. We have a choice that involves far more than just two things. But if we simplify it, we simplify things. The same processes we're using to categorize and making decisions between lots of different vehicles can really be taken down to an understanding of this binary choice, this or that. So, our two-key procedure. What's happening here is our two choices are running on what we call concurrent schedules of reinforcement. In other words, both of the schedules will provide reinforcers. Well, not specifically at the same time, but they're both active, right? So you've got a rat in an operant chamber. It presses the lever, you know, a fixed ratio, 25. After 25 responses, it gets some little rat food, okay? If we've got two levers in there, the rat can be pressing either. It doesn't have to complete one before going on to the next. You go back and forth. They're both operating at the same time. Remember I mentioned Las Vegas? We sometimes have people that are running, you know, three lottery machines at the slot machines at the same time, moving back and forth between them in some pattern. That's the same idea. It's not like they have to keep plugging. They're only working one machine at a time. Then when they're done, they unplug it, go to the next one simultaneously or concurrently they are in operation. Next thing here is that each of the keys is associated with its own separate schedule. You could have both keys operating on a variable interval 20-second, or you could have one of them operating on a fixed ratio 6 and the other one on a fixed interval 40-second. Okay, but they've each got their own schedule. They might both be the same, they might be different. And what we're going to be interested in here is how our subject is going to distribute its time or number of responses, its behavior, between the two choices. Okay? Now again, remember, there is going to be an acquisition period, right? You first put your subject into the situation, whether or not it's a rat, a pigeon, or a person. They've got to figure out what's going on. So there's a learning period here. Typically, because of this, what we do is we give the subjects some time to get familiar with the schedules that are operating on the keys, and we don't actually really analyze that initial data. Some people are interested, but usually we wait until they've achieved what we call more of a steady state level of responding. All right. So, what kinds of schedules could we set up? Well, perhaps the simplest thing to do would be to set up concurrent ratio schedules. So we're going to have two ratio schedules, one on one key, one on the other. What we find is this is actually stunningly boring from the sort of perspective of science. Let's just take a simple one. You've got a fixed ratio 1 on your left key and a fixed ratio 3 on your right key. Which key do you think our subjects are pretty much, unless they've got something very wrong in the head, are going to opt to go with exclusively after they've gone through the acquisition period? FI, or the FR1 or the FR3? Who votes for FR1? Okay, people won't put their hands up very much. FR3? Okay, we'll take that as nobody. And the rest of you that won't even do this. Cowards. Cowards one and all. Make a stand. Yeah, it's going to be the FR1. Think about it. You press, you get something. You press, you get something. You press, you get something. As opposed to 1, 2, 3, I get something. 1, 2, 3, I get something. I've said this before. We've evolved to be inherently lazy, right? How can we get the most stuff for the least work? Well, in this case, by opting for the FR1. So once the subjects figure out, wait a minute, on the left key, every time I press, I get something. But on the right key, I got to do 3 times as much. Well, that sucks. I'm just going to, and they ignore it. They stop pressing the right key there. So on concurrent ratio schedules, the subjects shift to whichever one is going to be easiest, whichever is going to give them the most for the least. Doesn't matter if you're a pigeon, a rat, a person. Consistently the same. So we don't tend to use those. Concurrent interval schedules. In this case, we've got we've got concurrent time-based schedules running here. Now, to maximize the amount of reinforcement the subject can get, the subject will have to move back and forth between these choices. The individual cannot stay exclusively on one. If you've got a fixed interval 5 seconds on your left key and a fixed interval 10 second on your right key, I say, well, okay, I'm just going to go for the fixed interval 5. Every 5 seconds, I make a response and I get reinforced. Okay, but you've completely ignored all the reinforcers that you could get from the fixed interval 10 second key. So on an interval schedule, you need to go back and forth. Even if you can get twice as many from our fixed interval 5, every 10 seconds or so, you want to pop over and hit the key on the fixed interval 10. Pick up that reinforcement and go back to the 5. Okay. Now, what we tend to get into is a fairly sort of stereotypic, repetitive behavior there. Press, press, pop over to the other press, and back. But at least they have to move between them. They won't exclusively stay... The subject won't exclusively stay on one option. What this means is that over the long term of the study, you've got something here which is allowing you to actually study choice. When are they going to shift? How many times are they going to shift? How many responses will they make on this key versus that key? So this allows us to study choice. Now, as I said, on an FIFI schedule, you get into what we call steady state responding. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on the left. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on the left. 5 plus 5 is 10, so then on the right. So it ends up with left, left, right, left, left, right. Okay? Subjects figure this out pretty quickly. Obviously, there's a margin of error here with respect to time estimation, but you get into these patterns. Because, I mean, it is a choice behavior, just that it's generally not all that interesting. You've seen this once, you pretty much got how it's going to go. Okay? Because of this, most of the studies involving choice done in comparative psychology utilize a variable interval schedule. So VIVI, concurrent schedules. You're not going to get into steady state in this case, right? Because there's no predictability. If you've got a VI 5 seconds, VI 10 seconds, on average, every 5 seconds, you can get reinforced on the left key. And on average, every 10 seconds on the right key, but that's just an average. There could be a reinforcer waiting after 1 second on the left and 36 seconds on the right. After you pick those up, it might be 8 seconds on the left and 4 seconds on the right. All right? So you can't get into that same kind of, I'm going to respond here for a bit, and then I'm just going to go over here and respond, and back and forth. Subjects have to be a little more in tune with what's going on, if you will. They have to be more sensitive to the rates of reinforcement. Because of this, these are the most typically studied protocols when looking at choice in the laboratory. Now, one of the things that does happen, even on a VIVI schedule, which was figured out pretty early on when people started studying choice this way, they discovered that there's actually kind of an easy way to maximize the amount of reinforcers you can get with relatively little sort of cognitive load for making a choice decision. This involves just shifting back and forth between the two options. So you get into simple alternation. So press, press, press on one, press, press, press on the other, press, press, press on the first, press, press, press on the second. So you just kind of go back and forth. By doing that, you actually do get a fairly simple pattern of behavior. It is a bit of an alternating behavior. And what this generally implies is the subject haven't really figured out the specifics of the contingencies that are in effect. They've kind of got a kludgy way of doing it. They're probably working a bit more than they have to, perhaps, but they're able to get pretty much all of the reinforcers there. This is sometimes called concurrent superstition. We don't know exactly why it happens with rats or pigeons or giraffes or whatever, because we can't ask them. But it could just be that they've, you know, early on in the learning process during acquisition, they stumble upon switching from one to the other tends to lead to a lot of reinforcement. So it could just be this sort of accidental conditioning thing. It could be that the brains have worked out that this actually, mathematically, is perhaps the best way to do it. We're not sure. Asking people, you say, well, why don't we just ask people? Yeah, people are stunningly vague about how they figure this stuff out. They have a hard time articulating these things. They clearly make choices, but sometimes people are very bad at explaining why they make the choice. Sometimes it comes down to, well, I just felt like. Fair enough. Thank you very much for taking part in the study. That really isn't going to get me my PhD or published in science, but score. Looking for a little more there. People have a hard time articulating this. So, what do we do to stop this? We put in what's called a changeover delay, or abbreviated as COD. Changeover delays, typically even fairly small changeover delays, stop this rapid switching back and forth, the alternation. There's two ways to do it. There's a sort of mechanical way of doing it, and then there's kind of a timing-based way of doing it. The mechanical way of doing it is really simple. You simply put a barrier between the two levers. So if, I'm a rat, probably easy for you to visualize, a bit of a plump rat that lives in the lab, okay? If one of my levers is here, and my other lever is over there, I've got a couple of, I've got a little barrier here, some chairs in the way. So if I think, okay, I've been on this lever for a while, now it's time to go over there, I've got to come around this barrier and come over to this side. Now, this takes me a little bit of time to do, so there is a cost. In the time that I have to go around this barrier, I'm not pressing either lever. If a reinforcer was suddenly available on the lever I just left, I could have had it if I'd stayed there. If a reinforcer is waiting over on this side, well, the time it took me to get there was lost. Okay, so having to go around something and move takes some time, right? Real world example, okay? You've got a couple of places where you could go get a snack, a lunch, or whatever. Okay, you can go to Hub, or you could go to Sub. All right, you're perhaps closer to Sub. You can get something there, but it's not necessarily your preferred snack of choice for the day. For whatever reason, you feel like this thing in particular. Why? I don't know. You just feel like it. Fair enough. You'd feel like something more from Hub, but you've got a limited amount of time here between a break and breaks between classes, so you can get to Sub easily, or you've got to walk all the way across campus to get to Hub, and then you might be late getting back. Which one are you going to go with? You take the one that maybe you prefer a little bit less, but it's closer and easier to get to, or are you going to take the additional time to go someplace else to get the one? Okay, so this is sort of a real world example of a change of delay. There is a delay. There is a penalty imposed for this kind of switching. So that's a very simple way of doing this. It turns out with rats and pigeons, and even people, it doesn't have to be a huge time delay. Even a relatively short barrier can do this. The second way of doing this is to actually use little clocks and little timers. Very easy to do now with computer control over the food dispensers and the levers and the keys and whatnot. The way you set it up here is, so let's say the subject's been working on the left, it's been pressing the left key, and it decides I'm going over to the right. Let's even assume that there is a reinforcer waiting for it on the right side. We're going to put a 3-second changeover delay in place. So our subject leaves the left key, just steps straight across, or even just reaches over to the right key. There is a reinforcer waiting there. However, the first response that is made after leaving the other option activates the changeover delay clock. So the first response starts a changeover delay clock. 1, 2, 3. The first response made on that choice after 3 seconds will count towards the schedule. Okay? So you've left the left side. You've pressed the right key. There is a reinforcer waiting, but the first response starts a clock. 1, 2, 3, the first response that's made after that 3 seconds elapse counts towards getting the reinforcer. If the subject comes over, presses, even presses a couple of times here quickly within the first 1.5, 2 seconds, and goes, nothing, goes back to the left key, presses there a couple of times quickly, nothing, goes back to the right, presses. At some point, there's reinforcers waiting on both, but if it switches back and forth quickly, it's never going to get them because it never stays anywhere longer than, in this case, our 3 seconds. So what this sets up is eventually the subjects figure, oh, wait, I've got to stay here a little while. If I'm going to switch, I have to stay. This forces subjects to really make a choice decision is this the time for me to go? Is this the time for me to switch to the other option? There's going to be a penalty, not a large penalty, say 3 seconds. That's not a big penalty. And frankly, 3 seconds works generally quite well with like rats and pigeons. But you got to make that choice. Is this the right time to switch? I've been responding on this key for a while. I've gotten a bunch of reinforcement, or I've gotten nothing. When should I go? Get back to, it's like the song. Should I stay or should I go now? Okay? It's the whole thing. That's choice behavior, right? Should I stay or should I go? Should I pick this or should I pick that? All right? So, changeover delay. Put this in place. You tend to avoid this rapid shuttling back and forth between options. All right. I'm going to take you through classic study in this. Hernstein's 1961 experiment. Hernstein, different people like different species to work with. Hernstein really liked pigeons, so primarily worked with pigeons. Utilized VIVI schedules, so two key concurrent VIVI schedules. He had a 3 second, I think it was 3 second, changeover delay, so small changeover delay there. And what he did is he set the overall rates of reinforcement between the two options constant at 40 reinforcers per hour. So every hour, working between the two alternatives, if the pigeons get it right, they can get a maximum of 40 little deliveries of pigeon food. So 40 individual deliveries of however many grams of food you get each time that a reinforcer is delivered. Okay, so he holds that constant. Now, let's take a look at some of his data here. This is basically Hernstein's actual data. I've like rounded the ones columns a little bit here just to make it slightly neater, but this is essentially what he got. So, first group of pigeons, key one, key two, they're both on concurrent VI 3 minute schedules. Incidentally, Hernstein gave his pigeons 17 days of training, and then he tested, that is, recorded the data over the last 3 days. So the pigeons have had a good long acquisition period to get used to what's going on, and he's only using data from days 18, 19, 20. Okay. So the idea that, well, if the pigeons are getting it wrong, maybe it's because they don't know what's going on. It's like, no, they've had a long time to get familiar with it. All right, so VI 3 minute schedule here, RFT slash hour, reinforcers per hour, RSP, hour, responses per hour. So reinforcers per hour, we've got the same schedule on both. It's being held constant at 40 per hour, so all other things being equal, assuming you can get it right, you could get 20 reinforcers from key one and 20 reinforcers from key two. That's the payout system. Now, the responses per hour, that's the actual behavior. That's the actual number of key presses. And I mean, it's actually something like 2,000 and 2,003 and 1,997 or something like that for the other one, but I just rounded. But it's essentially exactly the same. After 17 days of doing this, the pigeons figure out in their little bird brains that, yeah, they're the same schedules, and they spend as much time on one as the other. They make the same number of responses on key one as they do on key two. Now, our RFT reinforcement rate and RSP response rate. Okay. Now, if we do a little calculation here, the way to do this is like this. Hernstein said, looking at numbers, you know, the raw data is lovely, but you'd like to be able to standardize so you can compare across studies, across species, across situations, whatnot. So he said, okay, we're going to use proportional rates of reinforcement, proportional rates of responses here. So let's put some values in here. R1 is going to represent the amount of reinforcement available in key 1, R2, the amount of reinforcement available on key two. To get the proportional rate of reinforcement, say on P1, we go R1 divided by the total, R1 plus R2. So 20 divided by 20 plus 20, 20 divided by the total, 40 gives 0.5. So proportionately, half, 0.5, of the total amount of reinforcement is available on key 1, and half is available on key 2. You could flip this around and go R2 divided by R1 plus R2, and we get the same thing. Or, because there is only two choices here, and you know that out of two choices, it's going to have to total 1. You just go 1 minus whatever the proportional rate is on key 1. If you had a 3-key system, you've got to calculate at least 2 of them, and then through subtraction, you can get the third one. Okay, basic math there. All right. So we've got that. Now that's the given. That's the researcher has set that up. So in this case, Herrnstein set that up. What's more interesting is our second component, the proportional rate of responses. Now, I use B's for this. B standing for behavior. I think it's easier to remember. I think your textbook is using, I can't remember. No, they might use B as well. I think you might have switched this between additions. Or some people use capital R for the reinforcement, lowercase r for the responses. It doesn't matter, right? It's the idea, okay? There's going to be a question coming up on the fourth assignment, which I'll probably have up today, which is going to involve some calculations on this. I don't really care what you label these as long as you, well, as long as you get it right. No, as long as you understand how this works. Okay. So I'm going to use B's. B for behavior. So B1 is going to be the number of behavioral responses on key 1. B2, number of behavioral responses on key 2. Same deal. B1 divided by B1 plus B2. Well, 2,000 divided by 2,000 plus 2,000 is going to be 0.5. All right? You know, that's pretty simple and boring. It's like, well, yeah, I know, because the numbers worked out really nicely here, okay? This will get more exciting. You look thrilled, I can tell. Yeah, all right. Anyways, there we go. Now, what we see here is in this relatively simple setup, the pigeons are pretty good. If we take a look at this, their proportional rate of responding matches up pretty much exactly with the proportional rate of reinforcement. Let's take a look at the second group. Key 1, variable interval 9 minute. Key 2, variable interval 1.8 minutes. Now, in terms of the number of reinforcers available per hour, this would mean on key 1, 6.7 over the long term. So over the course of the study, you know, over 20 days, we would expect 6.7 out of the 40 reinforcers are going to be available on key 1 and 33.3 on key 2. All right? In terms of the actual responses made, the last 3 days, the pigeons are on average making 250 responses on key 1 and 3,000 responses on key 2. So let's calculate this out here quickly, go through it. So R1 divided by R1 plus R2 means that the proportional rate of reinforcement for key 1 is 6.7 divided by 40, or 0.17. So 17%, if you will, of the reinforcement is available through key 1. 83% of the reinforcement is going to be available through key 2. Now, how do the pigeons do in terms of their actual behavior? Well, let's get the proportional rate of responding here, or proportional rate of responses. B1 divided by B1 plus B2. 250 divided by 3,250. Total number of responses. We get a value here for B1 of 0.08. So 8% of the responses are on key 1, 92% are on key 2. Now, they haven't done quite as well as they did, as the first group did, right? In that case, 50% of the responses on key 1, well, key 1 also gets 50% of the reinforcement. Here, we get on key 1, 17% of the reinforces are available. The pigeons only spend about 8% of the responses there. Conversely, key 2, 83% of the reinforcers are available on key 2, and they spend a little bit more responses that are absolutely necessary, 92% of the responses are spent there. They're not perfect, but they're close. You know, they're in the ballpark. It's not like they were doing 0.5 and 0.5. Okay, so they've got the right sort of trend. They're a little bit off. I'm not going to go through all the details in this, but he has two other groups. One of them, VI 1.5 minutes. Second key, extinction. In other words, they never get anything from key 2. And this one, they don't really need 17 days of training, but he does it to be consistent. And he finds that by the end of this, the pigeons are making 4,800 responses on key 1 in an hour. And here we get a beautiful job of the pigeons figuring this out. 100% or 1.0 of the proportional rate of reinforcers comes from key 1, and that's where they put all of their responses. Last group here, VI 4.5 minutes on key 1, VI 2.25 on key 2. We end up with proportionate reinforcement of 0.33 or 33% on key 1, 0.67 or 67% on key 2. And here in terms of the proportional rate of responses, key 1, 0.31, key 2, 0.69. Pretty close. I mean, 33% versus 31%, 67 versus 69. So Herrnstein did this, and he took a look at his data, and he said, hey, it's almost as if the pigeons are matching the proportional rate of responding to the proportional rate of reinforcement that's available on that choice. So it seems they've matched it up. So, I mean, in the case of the first and the third groups, perfect matching. In the case of the second and the fourth groups, it's not perfect, but it's pretty close, right? That's the thing. When we say that matching has been achieved, we don't mean it has to be exact, down to 3 decimal places or whatever. It's just, okay, if you're probably within, 5 or 10%, that you're probably pretty good. So we've got matching. So all of his pigeons do a reasonable job of matching. Group 2, they're not quite as good here. We've got perhaps something that's called maybe a little bit of bias involved, or maybe this is just a really tough schedule for them to learn. Okay, the estimation is maybe hard, but good. Right? Pigeons have figured out which option is going to give you more, and they put more effort into that option. Which is giving you less, they don't just abandon it, unless it's giving you nothing at all, but they will proportionally put less effort into that. Same thing with courses, right? You've got a course that is important for your degree, or you're getting a job, or admittance into another program, you probably put relatively more work into that course than a course that is just an option. All right? The choice might be a valid choice, that's fine, but you proportionately tend to try to match things. So Herrnstein formulates what he calls the matching law, or more specifically, Herrnstein's matching law. He had a student named Baum, and piece of advice, if you go on for grad school and you're working on something with your supervisor, don't reformulate something that your supervisor has named after him or herself into a slightly different way and name it after yourself, at least not until you've actually gotten your degree, because Baum did that. So he said, Herrnstein's matching law is fine, but I'm going to redo this in a slightly different way and call it Baum's matching law. Made for a very tense defense, apparently, for Baum. Anyways, we're not going to worry too much about that, besides this little bit of trivia from the wonderful world of science. Herrnstein's matching law. It says the proportion of responses directed towards one alternative should equal the proportion of reinforcers delivered by that alternative. So if you have that happening, again, within a margin of error, you have achieved matching. And the basic the equation here that we saw, B1 divided by B1 plus B2 equals R1 divided by R1 plus R2. If those sides of the equation more or less match up, we can say, yes, we've got matching. If they do not, then something's happened. Now, that not matching up happens more often than one might suspect. When this occurs, it's called bias. The subjects demonstrate a bias towards one choice more than they should, for whatever reason. So you're spending more time on one alternative than would be predicted by the matching law. There's various reasons for this. It could be a side preference, that could be a conditioned side preference, so it could be learned, or it could be something that's just very biological. It could be a biological predisposition. The majority of humans are right-handed. Doesn't make them better than left-handed people. Doesn't make them worse. Just biologically, we've got a strong predisposition towards right-handedness. Consequently, right-handed humans are more likely to reach for things on their right. If you've got two buttons arrayed in front of you and you're making this response, you may hit the one on the right a bit more. That could be just a very biological side preference. Interestingly enough, non-humans tend to have hand or paw preferences as well. Rats do, monkeys do. But unlike humans, it tends not to be so lateralized. So rats, about 50% of rats are right paw dominant, and 50% roughly are left paw dominant. Same with most of the monkeys that have been studied, about 50% right, 50% left. Any individual monkey will prefer to use one paw or the other to do things, but it's about equal. So there's something a little bit unusual with humans here. But not all species are sort of equal in their preferences. You go back paleontologically and look at trilobites. You know what trilobites are? Things have been dead like for 500 million years or so. Little things like really ancient crab-like critters, big bugs under the sea. You find fossils for these, and paleontologists notice that on fossils that have been recovered, it's not uncommon to find damage, as if the trilobite had been attacked by something, and it scarred up the exoskeleton. They find consistently that these damage patterns, scar patterns, are on, I think it's the right side, which means that probably, at least the interpretation, the inference here, is that if something's coming at the trilobite, it would have a predisposition to turn to the left. So if you're suddenly turning away from a predator by going to the left, you're more likely to get damaged on the right side. Okay, could have been the other way around. Just for whatever weird little biological reason, go to the left. Okay, so biological preferences, predispositions. So we can get those. Now, you can generally account for those relatively easily. Simple little psychomotor testing can give you a determination of side preference. Could also be like visual preference. You have a dominant eye as well. So you can account for that. There can also be issues in terms of quality and amount that can bias things. Now, so far, we've just been talking about cases. I mean, in Herdstein's case, 40 reinforcers per hour held constant, and in his case, he made the on each individual presentation of the reinforcer, the amount that the pigeon received was the same. So, like half a gram of bird seed each time, no difference in amount. Or if you're doing rats, one M&M every time. Okay, so that would be a consistent amount. But in the real world, things are not always so consistent. You may get more or less, depending. So your amount could be higher or lower. Similarly, the quality could be better or worse. So if you just look at the simple behavior, B1 divided by B1 plus B2, and go, does this equal the proportional rate of reinforcers delivered, R1 divided by R1 plus R2? And if they don't match up, one should perhaps step back and go, okay, is everything being held constant? Do we have the same quality and amount on the two options? Two or more options in the real world. So, we can analyze for this very easily here. Let's put in a couple of values. So we'll say Q1 represents the quality of the first reinforcer, Q2 represents the quality of the second reinforcer. These are going to be constants. So now, we'd say B1 divided by B1 plus B2, does it equal Q2 Q1 times R1 divided by Q1 times R1 plus Q2 times R2. If the quality is held constant, Q1 and Q2 both equal 1, so they drop out of the equation. If the quality of the second option is better than the quality of the first, we might say, okay, so we'll set the quality of the second option at 1. The quality of the first option, maybe half as good, we'll set it at 0.5. So what are you going to go for? The one that's a little bit better quality? Okay. Now, see how this starts to get interesting. What if the first reinforcer, though, is available twice as often? It's only half as good, but you get twice, it shows up twice as frequently as the second one, which is twice as good, but is only showing up half as frequently. How do you partition your time? Well, we might get back into a balance there, or we might not. Okay, so quality. Now, the way we figure out quality is we have to actually do a first little study. So if you're working with rats, you'd say, okay, you're going to take a group of rats, give them a bunch, let's just use chocolate M&Ms versus their dry rat pellets. Okay, so it's like, well, we give them the choice. They can eat the M&Ms, they can eat the rat pellets. How much do they eat of the M&Ms? How much of the rat pellets do they eat? That'll give us a sense of quality. All right, so you've got to do that first. Okay? This is, again, why we so frequently work with rats and pigeons and gerbils and mice, because we can go back into the literature and find. People have already done these comparisons, set up different measures of quality for different types of reinforcers. So if you're interested in doing a study involving change in quality, we already know this stuff for the standard lab animals. All right, how about the amount? Well, same basic process here mathematically. A1 represents the amount on option 1. A2 represents the amount on option 2. So A1 times R1 divided by A1 times R1 plus A2 times R2. R2. If that equals your behavior, B1 divided by B1 plus B2, score, matching. Now, in terms of what is your A value, this is even easier because you can actually count that. So if something's going on here where you're giving on R1, you give 4 pieces of rat food, and on R2, you give 1 piece of rat food, that is going to produce a bias. You could have a variable interval 20, variable interval 20 minutes, like in our first case in Bernstein's study, but Q1 provides 4. Every reinforcer actually provides 4 times the amount of stuff as the second one does. You might see a preference. It's like, oh, if you miss picking up the amount of the reinforcer from the second key by a bit, yeah, no biggie. You're getting a lot more by being on Q1. Okay, so again, it could be a bias. Now, of course, in the real world, you can have everything happening at once. You've got differences in your rate of reinforcement, so your R value. You've got differences, potential differences in the quality, and you've got potential differences in terms of the amount. Think about, say, kids with Halloween, right? Okay, different houses give better or worse treats, right? Some are giving really good chocolate. The dentist gives out toothbrushes. So quality, you figure that out. Some will give differences in the amount, 1 piece of something versus 3 pieces of something. Okay? So amount and quality can vary. Or in my case, with looking for cars, right, I've got a whole series of variables to consider here. It starts to get very complicated. There's the actual cost of the car. There's issues with safety of the car. There's issues of fuel economy with the car. There are issues with interior space in the car. Luggage capacity of the car, towing capacity for the car. Okay, I got a lot of factors here that come into play. So these real-world situations become very, very messy. But in principle, we can reduce them down to some simple, relatively simple variables, at least conceptually. All right. So, choice. So thank you for choosing to come to class today. Good choice. Good choice. All right. We're going to... any questions about that? No? Okay. Well, we'll come back to it later. We'll talk about self-control. Need to drift back and talk a little bit more about extinction. There's a few sort of interesting additional things to talk about here. So I mentioned that what happens in extinction is once you've gone through your acquisition, now the contingency is being broken, so the presence of the discriminative stimulus, the response, no longer leads to the outcome. What we expect to see is that gradually responding will decrease, and that will be that. We said one of the things you commonly will encounter is what's called an extinction burst. There it is there. So this was a cumulative record from a rat that was on a CRF, that is a fixed ratio 1 schedule. And if you take a look over here, every response it made, one of those little ticks, indicates that a reinforcer is being delivered. And then we switched off the food hopper. So now it can respond all at once, but it's not going to get any food. And sort of take a look at the slope, just eyeball the slope here, okay? You know, to use a geographical or geological analogy, you know, this is like the foothills, and here, whoop, we've hit the mountains, okay? Notice much steeper slope. So the rat responds, nothing happens, and then it just starts pounding on the lever. Well, that's probably a good 30 or so responses in the space of maybe 10 seconds. Okay. Sort of stops for a little bit, you know, scratches its little furry noggin for a bit, comes back, whacks on the lever a bit more, stops responding for a while, hits the lever again, a bit of a furious response here. Okay. But comparatively speaking here, we're seeing that the overall slope here is going down. And if we'd continued this, we did continue it for another 10 or 15 minutes, the rat pretty much stops responding, just goes, sits in the corner and you know, washes its face or takes a little nap or does whatever, but more or less ignores the lever at that point. At that point, we'd say we've got extinction. We've extinguished the behavior. So there's the extinction burst. We talked about some examples in the real world of this, temper tantrums, people pulling Coke machines out of the wall, crushing themselves, these sorts of things. Not usually as problematic with rats. What's the worst they're going to do? They're going to, you know, kind of go medieval on that little lever. I've seen rats bite levers. You do get into some stuff where I've seen rats actually like attack other rats. So if you've got a second rat in the cage with it, they might like try to bite the second rat. You did this! No, the other rat didn't do that. The researcher did, but the researcher is at least well out of reach of the rat. Matter of fact, actually, you don't see this used too often anymore, but the biting behavior is pretty common in rats. And a common a measure of this used to be to use what was called a bite bar. It would be a little bar that would record the amount of bites that the rat would deliver on it. So when rats get frustrated, they bite things. So do pit bulls, as the case is. So there we go. So it used to be another measure of extinction. How much was the bar being bitten? Now, so that's extinction. And you can use it to stop behavior, but there may be some consequences of your actions there. extinction can create difficulties in lots of situations. So let's say that we want to stretch. It's called stretching the ratio or stretching the interval. Basically, we've started with a low contingency, so fixed ratio 1. So you respond, you get reinforced, you respond, you get reinforced. That's going to lead to our subject getting a lot of reinforcers. What if we want to get this up higher? So maybe they have to make 20 responses or 50 responses. before they can get the reinforcer. So we want to get more work for the same amount of payout. Well, we could just say, let's go from our low schedule, so my example here, fixed ratio 5, and let's just go straight to fixed ratio 50. We want them ultimately to make 50 responses to get a reinforcement. So they're on fixed ratio 5, and suddenly we just step it to FR 50. Huh. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What? Nothing. Bang, 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 bang. Nothing. Bang, 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 bang. Bite, 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 bite. I'm done, says the rat. Dude, you got to 37. If you just go a little bit more, you'd get the reinforcer. The rat's extinguished before it got there. I mean, maybe it has. In our hypothetical example, it has. So we can't just step it straight up. Same thing with the time, with intervals. We're on a VI 4 second, and we go up. We're going to step it up to VI 30. We might extinguish before the reinforcer is actually available. So what we have to do is essentially shape the subject up to a higher level. So we move it gradually in little steps, little increments. Okay? So we might go from a fixed ratio 5 up to a fixed ratio 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What the? Bam, bam, bam. Oh, there it is. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Bam, bam. Oh, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay, inflation. Yeah. There we go. We'll talk about economics in a while here. All right? Or, you know, on the variable interval, you know, you're into a particular pattern of responding. Is it steady, moderate? And, you know, we'll take it from variable interval 4 seconds up to maybe variable interval 7 or 8 seconds sort of thing. We'll probably be fine. And then, you know, the fixed ratio will go from 5 to 7, then maybe to 10, then to 15, maybe 22, 23. So we gradually move it up until we get to 50. By doing this, we will not get into the extinction problem. Okay? There'll be a brief... In fact, actually, extinction bursts can work for us. So a little, where's my rat yummy? Bang, bang, bang. Oh, there it is. Huh. Interesting. Off you go some more. So that can actually work for us. It can help us get the subject to the next sort of level that we've implemented. Just some terminology here. We're talking about low schedules. We're talking about things where it's like a relatively low number of responses or small amount of time must pass before reinforcement is available. A high schedule is something where there's a high number of responses or a long amount of time has to pass. So by stretching our ratio or interval, we're moving from low schedules to high schedules. Okay? And the higher we get, the more we can sort of expand these intervals. So you don't just have to keep stepping it up by 2 or 3. You can, after you've gotten up higher, you can make your jumps a bit larger. Okay? Now, with respect to... That's lovely. So we can try to avoid extinction in cases where we need it there. But there are some other interesting issues with extinction. So we mentioned continuous reinforcement. We said that a fixed ratio 1, pretty much the easiest way to condition a subject to make a response. Every time you make the response, you get the reinforcer. Pretty simple. Nice contingency, straightforward, high levels of reinforcement. The behavioral response is probably going to start happening pretty consistently. Downside, though, of a fixed ratio 1 is, while it's the easiest schedule to condition, it's also the easiest schedule to extinguish. If you've gotten used to every time you respond, you get something, and then you don't, that's pretty easy to extinguish as well. Okay. Now, continuous reinforcement. Continuous reinforcement is our fixed ratio 1. Every other schedule, technically, is what we call an intermittent schedule. Intermittent does not mean variable. Fixed ratio 2, fixed, is an intermittent schedule. Why? Because an intermittent schedule means every response does not necessarily produce a reinforcer. So, fixed ratio 2, respond, nothing, respond, reinforcer. Respond, nothing, respond, reinforcer. Reinforcement delivery is intermittent. Okay, so fixed schedules can be intermittent. Variable schedules, intermittent. And so the only thing that is not an intermittent schedule technically is a fixed ratio 1. Okay? So fixed ratio 1, all other things being equal, is going to be easier to extinguish than any other intermittent schedule. They said all other things being equal. This is what's called in the literature the partial reinforcement effect. So it's the nature of intermittent schedules that you only give partial reinforcement, which they mean it's not like giving part of a reinforcement. It means that only part of your responses get reinforced. So the partial reinforcement effect means that any schedules that are intermittent are going to be harder to extinguish than a continuous reinforcement schedule. Generalities here. Generally speaking, high schedules are harder to extinguish than low schedules. And again, all other things being equal, variable schedules are going to be harder to extinguish than fixed schedules. Okay? Somewhat broad generalities here. A bit of stereotyping. Mathematically stereotyping these different schedules. Probably wrong of me, but there you go. Now, that's an observation in terms of the differences between intermittent versus fixed schedules, continuous, not fixed. So intermittent versus continuous schedules in terms of extinction. But we'd like to have some theory involved, like what predictions can we make beforehand? How can we explain this? Why? The first of these theories is called the discrimination hypothesis. This one says that it's more difficult to discriminate between an extinction schedule, in which now responding leads to nothing, ever, and an intermittent schedule. So look, fixed ratio 1. Every time you respond, you've learned you get reinforced. The very first time you respond and you don't get reinforced, something's up. It's like, whoa! What just went wrong? Very easy to discriminate. Now, let's take a look at a high schedule. Let's say fixed ratio 100. Okay? You have to make 100 responses before you get reinforced. On an extinction schedule, how many responses do you have to make before you get reinforced? Well, all of them. an infinite amount. You will never get reinforced. So which is closer to extinction, a fixed ratio 100 or a fixed ratio 1? 100. Okay? It's closer to infinity. Not a lot closer. But still, closer. Fixed ratio 5 is closer to extinction than a fixed ratio 1. Variable interval 60 seconds is closer to your extinction than a variable interval 5 second. On average, every 5 seconds, you can get reinforced. Sometimes it's going to be 1 second. Sometimes maybe it's going to be 12 seconds for your variable interval 60 seconds, you know? Yeah, sure, sometimes 1 second, but sometimes it might be 400 seconds. That's kind of a long time. How much to get reinforced on extinction? How much time has to pass? All the time there is. Okay. So this is the idea of the discrimination hypothesis. It says any intermittent schedules are more like extinction than a continuous reinforcement schedule. Second, frustration hypothesis. This one says that on intermittent schedules, when you make a response that does not produce reinforcement, this is, quote unquote, frustrating. Okay? There is some degree of frustration that occurs because of this. On a continuous reinforcement schedule, every response is reinforced, consequently, zero frustration. You are never frustrated by responding on continuous reinforcement. But as soon as you're on a fixed ratio of 2, you do get frustrated. Response, nothing, some frustration. Response, reinforcement. Response, nothing, frustrated. Response, reinforcement, yay. Not a lot of frustration, but there's some, right? Fixed ratio of 5. Frustrated, 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 reinforced. Frustrated, 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 reinforced. Okay. All intermittent schedules will have at least some non-reinforced responses. Consequently, all intermittent schedules will have at least some frustration. Now, an interesting byproduct of this, in this theory, is that the amount of frustration that you're experiencing actually helps to continue the partial reinforcement effect. In other words, the frustration actually serves to explain why subjects will continue to respond longer when they're on extinction if they've been used to an intermittent schedule. In the same way that with the discrimination hypothesis, it's the fact that, so if you've got if you've gotten used to a schedule that's very close to extinction, you have a hard time telling it apart, right? It's like, I don't know, not, you know, if you're on a fixed ratio 100, 87, 88. By this point, actually, you're probably, if you're a non-human, you're just guesstimating. Rats can count. It's like, 1, 2, 3, lots? That's about it. Okay? I mean, there's some animals that count a bit better than that. You know, African great parrots, the occasional chimp. But, I mean, for a lot of animals, it's like, 1, 2, 3, 4, lots of stuff. Little kids? You can do this to little kids, too, right? What would you rather have, this one dime or these 5 pennies? You better do those pennies quick because they're going to go away real soon, right? One dime or 5 pennies. Take your pick. 5 looks like more. Take the 5 pennies. Oh, excellent choice. This one $20 bill or these 4 shiny loonies. You can mess with kids like this all you want until they learn math. And then it's like, Dad, by my calculations, you've been ripping me off for like 6 years. You owe me in back pay. It's like, oh, yeah. Anyways, rats, same way. Take the piece of rat chow, smash it with a hammer, break it into lots of little pieces. Take a single piece of rat chow. What do you want? That looks like more. Go for the broken up rat chow. Yeah. Okay. So, in discrimination hypothesis, it's just harder to tell. High schedules seem, it's harder to tell the difference between them and extinction. So, we put you on an FR100. We now put you on extinction. How long does it take before you actually realize you're on extinction? Probably a heck of a long time. With the frustration hypothesis, this looks at it in a different way. It says you've gotten used to being frustrated, right? Matter of fact, on an intermittent schedule, the more frustrated you are, the closer you are to actually getting the reinforcer. Once you're good and frustrated, that's telling you the reinforcer's got to be getting close. If you're not very frustrated yet, you've got a long ways to go. So you just keep pressing away, making the responses. If you're quite frustrated, you're making a lot of responses, and you still haven't gotten reinforced, frustration has been building, but that's okay. In the acquisition phase of this, you've learned, the more frustrated I am, the closer I'm getting to actually that final payoff. The more frustrated you are with me and having to study for this damn course, the closer you are to being done with it. Okay? No, it's okay. You can be happy about that. It's all right. It's cool. All right. So, the frustration acts as a discriminative stimulus. That little S plus there is a shorthand for an excitatory discriminative stimulus. So it says reinforcement is coming. Right? Now, why do subjects continue to respond during extinction? Why do we have this partial reinforcement effect? The higher the schedule, why do they respond longer as compared to, say, a continuous reinforcement? With continuous reinforcement, respond. Now suddenly respond, nothing. Bang, a little extinction burst in, pretty much over and done with. No frustration has been experienced on CRF. You know, used to being frustrated. The first time they're frustrated, it's when you're on extinction and, I'm going to stop. If you're really used to being frustrated, how much frustration are you going to get on extinction? Lots, because you're never actually going to get reinforced, right? So lots of frustration occurs. What's frustration tell you? Frustration tells you you're actually getting closer to the reinforcer, so you keep responding. Okay, so this is the frustration hypothesis. Sequential hypothesis. This one says that, again, on intermittent schedules, responses are going to be followed either by reinforcement or by non-reinforcement. Okay. On an intermittent schedule, a non-reinforced response becomes an excitatory discriminative stimulus, saying eventually, sooner or later, if you just keep going, you will, in fact, get the reinforcer. Higher schedules, it is said, increase a subject's resistance to extinction because they've gotten used to having lots of non-reinforced responses in a row. These non-reinforced responses become a discriminative stimulus saying, yep, we're getting closer to getting reinforced. Ooh, I've had a whole string of non-reinforced responses. That says, I'm on the right track. Just keep responding, and I will get my reinforcer. So in this sense, again, extinction looks similar to a high schedule. The lowest schedule you can get is CRF, right? So anything other than that, you get into a partial reinforcement effect. Last one. The response unit hypothesis. This one says, you know, people are thinking about it all wrong, actually. It says it's a bit of a con here. The partial reinforcement effect is actually incorrect. See, it says what you have to do is you have to think about behaviors as units. So not individual responses per se, but units. So on fixed ratio one, one response is one unit. One unit leads to reinforcement. On a fixed ratio of two, two responses equal one unit. And one unit, again, leads to reinforcement. So you don't say, according to the response unit hypothesis, you don't go on an FR2, response failure, response success. You just go response success. So, unit outcome. A little bit of a semantic shell game here, actually. But based on this interpretation, the partial reinforcement effect is completely an artifact. So, Maurer and Jones have some data that seems to support this, or at least support the response unit hypothesis, if we look at it. So the greenish, teal, bluish lines represent the absolute number of responses that are made. The red bars indicate the behavioral units that we've got. Okay? So on an FR1, well, your absolute number of responses and your number of behavioral units are exactly the same thing because one response equals one behavioral unit. On FR2, these were rats that were trained to press to respond to get reinforcement. On an FR2, we've got like, what, about 190 responses on average. Here's a number of responses during extinction, so number of responses before they extinguish, about 190. But remember, on FR2, two responses equals one unit, so we've only got about 85 behavioral units. Oh, look, if we think about this in terms of units, the number of actual units decreases as we go on to a higher schedule. It doesn't increase, as partial reinforcement effect would lead you to suspect. terms of the absolute, it does, right? Absolute says the more, the higher the schedule, the more responses are going to be made before extinction. And we get that here, right? So our blue lines keep going up. The higher the schedule, the more responses are made before extinction. But if we do this in behavioral units, the number actually goes down. Now, as I said, this is a little bit of a con, if you will, right? I mean, as soon as you say, well, we're going to treat this in terms of behavioral units, then yeah, you're going to get this. The question is, do subjects actually think in terms of behavioral units? There's not a lot of great evidence for this. Most people think about, you know, say the components in a job, the things that you have to do as individual things, not, you know, it's not like when it comes down to it, you know, I had to read. If that was the case, people shouldn't really care very much whether they're having to read a 30-page chapter or a 70-page chapter. It's still one behavioral unit, reading a chapter. But it's like, can you believe it? The chapter is like 70 freaking pages! Or, you know, the 800-page textbook versus the 90-page textbook. Oh, it's still a behavioral unit of one textbook you have to read for the course. Or even, like in English, you know, you have to buy 12 books for this. But don't worry, the books are all relatively short versus somebody going, I had to buy 12 books? Well, in this class, I only have to buy one book. Right, you know, the Norton Anthology of English, which is like 1,200 pages or something, right? So you may end up reading a lot more when you take the one book, but it seems like more when you break it up in individual books. Okay, so there's not a lot of great evidence that suggests that we really think about things in units. So, sure, the response unit hypothesis can in fact show that the partial reinforcement effect doesn't hold if we think about this in terms of units, but there's not a lot of great evidence that says that rats or pigeons or people, oh my, actually think about things in terms of units. They tend to think more about things in terms of responses. Okay? Hey, I mentioned earlier we'd come back and talk about economics. We'll talk a little bit about economics here in the context of operant behavior. Back in the late 50s, early 60s, economists and behavioral psychologists started to notice that they were talking about things in kind of a similar way. I like to believe this is because at universities they got invited to the same cocktail parties and they just happened in a bit of a martini-fueled haze of discussion about what they were doing, came to the conclusion that there were some similarities between economic theory and behavioral theory, but it probably was nothing quite as glamorous as that at all. Behavioral psychologists very rarely get invited to cocktail parties. It's actually kind of sad. Economists probably do a lot more, but they tend to make more money, too. Anyways, moving on and setting aside that amount of depression in our lives, there are similarities between economic theory and operant behavioral theory. And in fact, this led to this crossover between the fields. So we can actually apply economic theories to economic terminology to behavioral situations. On the flip side is we can also take and apply behavioral theory into economics, and it's done. It's done both ways. So here's the analogy. Behavioral psychologists will talk about responses made or the amount of time spent on something. Economists tend to talk about how much money did you spend on an item. Now, the total number of responses or the total amount of time possible, say in an operant chamber, and that's what a behavioral psychologist talks about, and the economist talks about income, your total amount of income, the maximum amount of money you've got. Psychologists talk about schedules. Economists talk about price. But these are very comparable things. Let's take a peek here. Now, if you've taken any economics courses, you will almost certainly have encountered some discussion of issues of consumer behavior and what's called consumer demand. This is usually represented by what's called a demand curve. The demand curve plots the price of some item and how much of that item is actually purchased. One of the interesting things that we find is that different items have different what's called elasticity of demand. That is, as the price changes on an item, as the price either goes up or down, there will be differences in the amount that is bought for some things, not for others. So inelastic products are ones for which, as the price increases, you still see a relatively high degree of purchasing. The item is still being bought. There may be some decrement in the amount that's purchased, but still fairly high. Compare this to an elastic product. As the price goes up, the amount that is purchased goes down markedly. Okay, so inelastic and elastic products. as the price of, if the price of Coca-Cola suddenly jumps up to $8 a can, people will probably stop buying Coca-Cola. If the price of gasoline goes from, say 40 cents a liter up over a dollar a liter, that's happened. Yeah, people just keep buying gas. That's what we call an inelastic product. There are factors involved here. The availability of substitutes. You can't substitute, now see, to use behavioral speak, you can't substitute what are called complementary reinforcers. Economists would say complementary items or products. So food and water. You need both of them to survive. It's like, oh, the cost of food has just gone way up. No problem. Water is free. I'll drink that. I'll be fine. For a while, you will. Then you won't. Right? So you still need both. You can substitute non-complementary reinforcers. So Coke and Pepsi. So I mean, unless you're my friend Earl, who absolutely refuses to drink Pepsi for ideological reasons, if the price of Coke goes up, most people will be willing to drink Pepsi. Okay, or flip side. If the price of Pepsi goes up, some people will drink Coke. I mean, you go into a restaurant, you know, it's like, okay, have a Coke, please. Oh, we got Pepsi. Most people go, yeah, okay. I mean, think about it. It's got caffeine, it's brown, it's syrupy, and it has bubbles in it. Do they taste different? Yes, fine, they do. Brown, syrupy, caffeine, bubbles. Eh? Except for my friend Earl, who's just like, oh, no, never mind. We should go somewhere else. No, man, we're seated here. We waited 40 minutes to get in. Just have your damn water. Okay. So availability of substitutes. Can you substitute this or not? Price range. This becomes an interesting one. And this is perhaps easier to see if we think about this in terms of actual schedules. So going from a fixed ratio 3 to a fixed ratio 5, we can put this into a ratio 3 to 5. We have to do two more responses. Versus fixed ratio 30 going to fixed ratio 50. 30 to 50, that's the same 3 to 5 ratio, right? But there's something categorically very different. In the first case, you only have to do two more responses to get the reinforcer. In the second case, you have to do 20 more responses to get that reinforcer. Think about this. If we just jumped from, we talked about extinction, if we said we want to get up to fixed ratio 50, we're going to jump it from fixed ratio 30 straight to 50. We would probably get into some problems with extinction here. If we go from fixed ratio 3 to 5, we'll probably be okay. Economically, right? If you're Starbucks latte goes from 3 to 5. You're a bit bent about this. I don't know, maybe the latte is already $5. I don't know. But if it makes a little jump of a couple bucks, you're kind of annoyed with it. But if something jumps $20, it's exactly the same proportion, it's the same ratio, but people get a lot more upset about that one. Okay? and are much less likely to pay, in economics terms, much less likely to pay that additional $20 if it's done in one big jump. Same way, you're more likely to extinguish if we try to stretch the ratio that far. Last factor is income level. So the higher total, behavior speaking, the higher total amount of responses you can make or the amount of time you have to perform the behaviors, the less effect an increase in cost is going to have. So the less effect increasing the ratio, stretching the ratio, stretching the interval is going to have. So if we increase the total amount of income, economically speaking, so if you have a very high income, right, does Bill Gates care very much if the price of his latte goes from $3 up to $5? Probably not. He probably just buys Starbucks at that point. Gets it for free, or buys all of the coffee-producing countries in South America and then pours the Starbucks to whatever, okay? If you've got a very high income, you don't really care too much if things step up a bit. If you've got a relatively low income, it's like, oh, geez, that's proportionally a big amount of my total income I've got. Yeah, I'm kind of concerned about that. Shurtleff and colleagues, 87, had two VI schedules running. Now, in this case, the VI schedules, concurrent VI schedules, on one of them, the rats could get food, and on the other, they could get saccharin water. Saccharin has no caloric value, but it tastes sweet. Rats like things that taste sweet. Now, when the schedules were on high, so they were set to high schedules, so you had to make a lot of responses to get these, and the rats had a limited amount of time in the operant chamber. I should point out, the only way the rats were getting their food or their saccharin was in the chamber. Okay, they never got food in their home cage. Okay? If they wanted to get their food, they had to get it here. On high schedules, the rats pretty much responded on the food lever. They needed to be able to get enough food to live. They wanted the saccharin, but it's not going to keep them alive. So they switch. They choose to respond almost exclusively on the food. At low schedules, the rats can get enough food they need to eat pretty quickly, pretty easily. It doesn't take very many responses to get that. And then they spend more responses on the saccharin. Now they can get their treat. No survival value in the saccharin, but they really like it. So this is the concept of luxury items. People that do not have a lot of income tend not to purchase luxury items. So that's the economics of luxury items. If you have a high amount of income, you are more likely to purchase luxury items. Luxury item is something that's not really essential, it's not necessary. Might be a big perk if you have it, but if it's a choice between survival things, things you need to live, or textbooks, or whatever it happens to be, if you're on a low income, you put the resources into that. If you're on the high income, then you can switch over and get some more of the luxury items. Okay. This is not just rats that do this, and demonstrated with primates as well. If you set it up such that the only way the primates get their survival resources is by responding on the levers in the chamber, they will respond more to the items they need, the food, the water, than they will for perks. Now, the interesting thing here, here's another way. So I said here, high schedule, low schedule. There's a study done with chimpanzees. Chimps were given like 1 hour in the chamber a day. And yes, they tend to respond more on the food and water levers than their perk levers, their toys and other things. But then another group of chimps just lived in the chamber 24/7. At that point, get up, wander over to the lever whenever they want a snack, whack the food lever, get some food, get a banana, get a piece of fruit, whatever it was, and also go over and whack their perk levers as well. You got all the time in the world. You've essentially got an infinite income. Okay? So we see the same pattern in operant situations, controlled situations, and we see very close parallels out in the real world in terms of economics. We've talked a couple times already about issues with respect to drugs. And we can see some interesting parallels with this when we bring the economic models and the behavioral models together. So, for obvious reasons, it is not ethical for us to take a group of first-year psychology students and get, you know, half of them addicted to crack. That's... We could try to put, you know, I sometimes get half tempted just to like to, you know, try to put something like that through the ethics protocols just to see how far it's going to get before someone says, seriously, are you joking? It's like, yes, I am. Just testing you to see what happens. But we can do this with non-humans. And in fact, this has been done with a variety of non-humans from rats up to various primates. So here's some data from a study with rhesus monkeys. Before I tell you about that, here, let me just give you a little bit of other information that you probably already know, but we'll just contextualize this here. Very common approach by governments, law enforcement, with respect to illegal drug purchasing is, if we just cut down the supply, so if we can stop the drugs getting across the border, getting into the country, getting into the city, if we can stop that, that'll force the price up. And once it becomes expensive, the addicts will stop being able to, they can't afford to buy it, so they'll stop buying it, and they'll get off the drugs. Does this work? Hell's no. This approach has been tried for, well, the better part of the 20th century and still being employed into the 21st century. It doesn't work. History shows us this. Behavioral science shows us this as well. Here's one example. We can do this with non-drug stuff as well, but let's just do it with heroin here, okay? So some rhesus monkeys were made addicted to heroin, okay? To get their heroin fix, they would have to make responses in an operant chamber. Low, medium, high, very high. They stepped up the number. They stretched the ratio. At a low ratio, monkeys are whacking the lever. They're just high as a kite, okay? They're feeling good. Right? Medium, it's we've stretched the ratio up to a medium. They're still responding at a very high rate to get their heroin. We take it up to a higher shed. We stretch it even further. Well, we get a little bit of a decrement here, but honestly not a lot. They're still responding pretty much the same. It's not until we stretch this to a super high level, super high being a very technical term in the sciences that we use, yeah, very high, super high, that do we see any sort of real drop in the amount of responding here. But it hasn't gone to zero. Taking up to a really high level has not caused extinction. The monkeys keep responding. They still want their drug. So the price of the drug initially is low. Governments, police, border patrols cut down on it, right? Less is coming in. The dealers increase the price to compensate. Addicts still pay it. You get even better at cutting off drug supplies coming. Price goes up. Addicts still pay it. Addicts don't stop and say, hey, you know what, you're right. This is kind of expensive. I should quit. Yeah, it's sad, but this is a very addictive drugs are inelastic products. Okay? Gasoline used to be like 32 cents a liter. Now like, you know, $1.15 peak summer. That's gone up way faster than inflation over the last 20-odd years. Right? And yet people still pay. We're a bit addicted to our cars. Gotta drive. Right? We'd have to jump the price of gas. You know, people say, what's it going to take to get people to stop driving? Probably jumping the price of gas up to about 10 or 12 bucks a liter overnight. Well, are we addicted to gasoline or do we have no choices? That becomes an interesting question. We do have choices. Many of us just don't like using them.
Well,
Yes, I agree. And there are problems. So where you live, yes. Is there good public transport in everywhere in Edmonton? No, public transport sucks in Edmonton. But that's not the case in all cities in the world. You can get pretty much anywhere in Paris on metro and public transit far more easily than driving. Edmonton has made a choice to have poor transit. And people choose to live places for other various reasons, sometimes because of cost, other things. So there are choices, there are choices, there are choices. Real-world choice becomes complicated, in the same way that Edmonton chooses, as a city, to sprawl. We have room. We don't have any natural barriers. The city will just keep expanding because it is cheaper to build out on the outskirts than it is to build an interior and revitalize neighborhoods. That is a choice. That is fine. But there will be consequences because of those choices. Anyways, with respect to drug addictions, yeah, there is a pharmacological addiction here. So what do we see? As the price goes up, we don't stop using, don't stop buying the drugs. In fact, what we get is we get people that are addicted who perhaps were very nonviolent or didn't do other crimes. Their crime was they're addicted to a drug. But now to be able to afford to pay for this very much increased drug, now they've got to do property crime or violent crime. So what you not uncommonly find is as the street price of the drug goes up, so does your crime. Now, the correlation comes in, drugs cause crime. Yes, fine, you have found a correlation. Incredible, well done. Nice use of descriptive statistics. Why? Well, when the price of the drug was low, perhaps the amount of violent or property crime was also lower. If you could make enough money working a low-paying job to meet your survival needs and get your drug. All right. Anyways, so with respect to this approach, trying to control drugs that are getting out into the streets or the public, this is not a good system. This is not likely to work. The price would have to go so high that we just can't effectively manage this. This may have some effect on first-time users. So it's like, how much? Whoa, no, I don't think I really want to risk getting addicted for that price, which is why what do drug dealers do? First one's free. Just try it out. See if you like it. Ellsmore and colleagues, 1980, work with baboons. Baboons are generally, they're primates, so relatively speaking, they have a larger brain than, say, cows or something, proportionate to body mass, which cows are nice, but they're not that bright. But what a baboon's head mostly consists of is teeth. Lots and lots of teeth. I'm sorry, the Lion King with the nice baboon is like Simba, it's the great circle of life. You know, the wise one? No, I mean, in reality, he's like, lion cub, I will eat it. It's like, baboons. Okay, so we've got baboons, and now they're hooked on heroin. Yeah, people are laughing with that nervous, I'm not going into that lab. Exactly. Yeah. Ellsmore and colleagues, either very brave or very foolish. Anyhow, so you get baboons and you get them hooked on heroin. They have a choice. They can either get their food or they can get their heroin. The way this is set, and frankly, the way they did this was they didn't go in and like give the baboons shots of heroin because they weren't going near them. Because what's going to happen? I mean, you know, the researcher's going to be mugged for the heroin he's carrying by the baboons, probably eaten as well. Gets both the food and the heroin. So they cannulate the baboons. The baboons are permanently cannulated, and heroin can be injected into them without anyone having to go into the room, as can tranquilizers be put into them if needed. So they're in an operant chamber. In the first case, every 2 minutes, a little panel opens. And there are two buttons there. There's the food button and the heroin button. Okay? And we find here that when every 2 minutes the panel opens, they can make a choice. we get a comparable response rate. They will respond as much for the food button as they will for the heroin button. And again, this is the only way they can get their food and their heroin. When we bring this up to the panel only opens once every 12 minutes, right? Notice we get a real decrease in the amount of responding to the heroin. They really want their fix. Okay? You got a baboon with a little tiny, you know, addiction monkey on its back. But if they don't get enough food to eat, they're dead. If you're dead, you can never enjoy heroin again. Kind of the horns of a dilemma there. Right? So they respond more on the food. Okay, so he says, well, look, this has actually led to a nice reduction in the amount of heroin, the amount of drug that's being used. So why don't we implement this in the real world? Because, I mean, how? Right? I mean, there's lots of places you can go to get food. Nobody's controlling that. No, you can only get both your food and your drugs, your heroin, from the same place. You must go to your food dealer and your drug dealer. The same person, corner of the market. It doesn't happen, right? The only way you can actually successfully, and this is actually a good way to reduce drug intake. Take it down, get it a little bit under control, and then use other techniques to try to stop the addiction entirely. But the only way you can implement this is if you have a completely closed and controlled environment, right? So you've got to have addicts that are checked into someplace where they just can't leave. Wait, is that ethical to withhold food? Or is it ethical to provide drugs? This is why you've got to have people sign waivers as well, okay? Right, so if you've got someone that checks themselves into this kind of program, this can work. It's going to help take the amount of drug use down to a lower level. Then you can use other techniques to gradually completely extinguish the drug addiction. But this has to be something where they can't, like, just leave and, you know, go buy their food at Burger King and then come back and go, oh, I'm here for my heroin now. Right? I mean, no. Everything is just inside this compound, this facility, all your food, all your heroin. Here's your choice. What do you want right now, your food or your heroin? Yeah. Okay, so very difficult to implement in a non-controlled let's take a break. So come on back in 10 minutes. So about 17 past, and we will continue.